This is London Calling.
You are listening to Thought and Leaders.
Hello, 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 and welcome again to another global podcast that is Thought and Leaders. I scour this amazing, beautiful, elegant planet of ours to find the most interesting, thoughtful leaders out there from all walks of life. Now, this particular episode is something very, very special because I have several guests pondering over a question. Is the high street post-COVID dead? First of all, Martin, it's a great privilege to have you here. Before you answer that question in terms of is the high street dead in a yes or a no answer, and then we're going to sure. More deeply in terms of the conversation, give us a bit of a elevator pitch on yourself.
Sure. I've been working 37, 38 years. My time has been split between being a retailer, running multi-channel operations for brands like Harrods, Burberry, Ted Baker, Pentland Brands. I've also been a service provider into retail for the other half of my time. I built and sold a very successful consulting business called Practicology. These days, I run a company called the Customer First Group. My focus is on customer centricity, customer service. I've written books about it. I do online education about it, and I advise boards about it.
Brilliant. Go on then, Martin. Is it dead or not?
100% not. No, it's evolving, but it's definitely not dead.
Paul Brooks, hello.
Good afternoon, Jonathan.
Good afternoon, sir. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name's Paul Brooks. I've spent the majority of my career in retail, mainly working for them, for the majority of that time creating store environments, windows and creative environments for some of the top retailers in the world, most of the time with my own company, which I sold 18 months ago. And for the last 18 months, basically, I've been using that time to help many of them pivot into this new retail world that we see very quickly evolving before our eyes.
Aha. So you know what I'm going to ask, and I've got a feeling I know what your answer is going to be. Dead or alive, Paul?
100% alive and kicking.
Very good. Okay, Jonathan Sands, hello.
Hello, Jonathan. Thank you very much for having me on the show. So I founded and operated something called the London Film Museum in 2008, which was located at County Hall and then later in Covent Garden, showcasing the James Bond collection. We presented things with exhibition, retail, food and beverage. And then I also founded and ran a chain of IP-themed retail shops, one of which was at King's Cross Station and amongst others from London, Melbourne, San Francisco, New York, servicing about 2 million customers a year. I sold that business about 2 years ago, and I've recently set up my company, which is helping and advising brands and entertainment franchises with retail and product executions. Do I think the high street is dead? Absolutely not. I think consumer habits have changed, but it's very much here and very much here to stay.
And we've also got Susanna Streeter.
Hello, great to be here. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Do you want to just give us an elevator pitch on yourself?
My name's Susanna, and I'm a senior investment and retail analyst at Hargreaves Lansdown. And I spent 15 years as a BBC broadcaster, business broadcaster, looking at various trends right across the high street and beyond. And in my role here at Hargreaves Lansdown, I look at the effect of current retail trends on listed companies in particular.
Mm-hmm. Susanna, in a word, yes or no, is the high street dead?
Absolutely not. The high street isn't dead. It just has to find a new vision for itself and carve out a kind of new role and deliver what shoppers need. And what shoppers need has changed dramatically. We've seen a shift and retailers having to adapt to this accelerated shift to digital shopping that they didn't expect for another 10 years. For example, AO.com, the chief executive, he said that they had to shift in 10 months, make changes to the business, that they didn't expect to have to do for another 10 years. So, and I think that experience has been replicated up and down the high street. And those retailers who have managed to cope with this accelerated shift to digital have done very well over this past year. Those who haven't, those who just found it so unexpected and didn't expect it, and didn't have those systems in place with which to manage this shift, they have really struggled. And I think it's going to be managing the shift to digital, but also providing the experience that shoppers still want, because people still do want to go out and shop, which is going to be the real challenge for retailers going forward.
So it's a unanimous verdict at this early stage that it is absolutely alive. And as Paul told us, not only is it alive, but it is kicking as well.
On the Shop Floor, a retail panel discussion from Thought and Leaders.
Okay, so I'm going to put this to Martin. Martin, there's been 118 Debenham stores alone that have closed.
You need to almost decouple what's happened during the pandemic from what was already happening with retail anyway. So retailers in the main, particularly the big multinationals, the likes of Debenhams, basically overexpanded their store footprint, didn't really address the fact of, you know, around channel shift and customers starting to buy online. And they found themselves to too many stores, which is why a lot of those big groups have been through their CVAs. And sadly, for some of them, you know, ultimately, in the case of Debenhams and the likes of Arcadia, have gone to the wall because they just didn't have the right operating model anymore, you know, and they had underinvested in digital opportunity and arguably overinvested in the physical one, at least in terms of the number of stores. So whilst the high street still got a very strong presence and will be there forever in time and memoriam, I think if you want to be relevant and you want people to come to your shops, you've got to make it interesting, you've got to make it experiential and give them reasons to come in. Otherwise, if online is really convenient, as many have found out for the first time during the pandemic, that's where customers will go.
Are you honestly telling me, Jonathan Sands, that prior to COVID, there wasn't much of an experience when people went into a retail outlet?
We came from a visitor attraction background. So when we later went into retail, we interjected our curatorial expertise and our experiential elements of whether it was photo opportunity and animations around the store to create this kind of well-rounded sort of execution. It was less of a retail play and more of an experience play. Yeah. So that purchasing items became kind of secondary, and it was more about having fun, creating a destination. Trust and loyalty are earned. If people are having a good time, they will naturally trust that and want to buy from that. But if they're not having much fun and the atmosphere is pretty drab and negative, then you don't feel like buying anything.
People want to have fun when they go shopping. But Paul, sometimes you want to go shopping just to buy something, get in and get out again.
Yeah, I have spent a career, whether it's saying to retailers or whether it's saying to the various creative directors I spoke to of these retailers, what is it that the customer wants? And then if you take it a step further back, the customer has absolutely massively changed. The consumer, the customer, the shopper has moved on a couple of generations. They've also been presented with a lot of tools, the main one being a handheld device called a smartphone. Mm. It's about just looking at your customers. I would always focus there first. So when we talk about experience, it's about bringing that experience to the customer, whatever channel you're on. Yes, experience is something that, you know, going back to my grandfather's Father's Day when they went shopping, they had an experience that was relevant for that time. The consumer and the shopper has changed hugely.
Martin, Paul there was talking about the idea that the shopper now has a smartphone. And he was also talking about his grandparents and when they went shopping. But the thing is, surely, experience is about the salesperson, about how he or she speaks to the customer. I mean, all this other stuff with smartphones and all the rest of it, is it just gimmicky?
The simple answer is no. I think it's about everything. And I think that what Paul was alluding to there is, you know, it's about convenience for some people. It might be about something else for others. Mm. I do a lot of high street videos, travel around the world. I interview consumers in London, New York, Dubai, Sydney, Melbourne, you name it. And when I ask them about what they don't like about the physical retail experience, they always say the same two things. One, there's never enough staff to serve them in the stores. And two, particularly when they're in the big national chains, the experience is too similar. It's too homogenous. And one of the advantages that smaller independent retailers have is when you go in there from a product point of view, you often don't know what you're going to find. And that's part of the allure of an independent retail experience, you know, is what am I going to discover today? So there's a discovery element. Uh-huh. But also, they may well know you. They might know you by name, your family, what you like, what you don't like. And it's more personal. So it's more engaging. And I think these are just some of the aspects that these bigger national chains have really lost sight of as they've scaled their business over the years. And they become big entities that have been driven by head office that have lost that kind of personal, localized experience, whether that's around merchandising, marketing, communications, and service. And your point about frontline staff, I mean, they are, at the end of the day, the lifeblood of any business. And you win or lose customers based on the experience you have with those people.
Paul Brooks.
Going back to, I think it was Jonathan's point, the transaction doesn't have to happen in the physical store. Online has obviously showed that. The success of Amazon has showed that. But that doesn't get away from the fact that true emotionally rich connections, which are basically how retailers get their customers and keep their customers, are A, cheapest, and B, easiest to do in a physical environment. So the transaction doesn't necessarily have to happen physically anymore. It's about retailers understanding, actually, that their relationship between them and the consumer has to change between moving product for them to be thinking about moving hearts and minds, basically. Mm-hmm. It's much more difficult and more expensive to happen online. I mean, that's why some of these pure play digital businesses, they're going to have to invest in a physical store.
Jonathan, you wanted to add something to that?
Yes. Following from what Martin and Paul were saying, I think if you can successfully bridge the gap between a traditional bricks and mortar business and an online robust e-commerce offering, and when I say bridging the gap, I don't just mean by having one or the other or both and just being a shop or just an online e-com offering, but if both work in harmony to serve the customer, whether it's click and collect, shared database, all that kind of stuff, where you're keeping in touch with your customers. We found it easier because we were a very small operation. We were able to interject all these technologies, where larger companies find it a lot harder to change and incorporate some of this technology. But there is so much available now that enables you to keep in front of your customer, learn about your customer, learn about what they want when the next thing is in that they're looking for, being able to get in front of them just so that your brand stays relevant.
Martin, increasingly what's going to happen is that department stores and so on and so forth are going to be more like showrooms. So people look around, check it out, and then go online and buy it there.
Some people, depending on who they are, will prefer the physical experience. Some will prefer the digital, and many will interact across both. I mean, if you think about it, even these days or prior to the pandemic, if you were going to a store and you wanted to know whether or not they had something you wanted to buy, you checked it on your phone, first of all. So our experiences invariably are multi-channel. Where we conclude our purchase or where we do our discovery might be different.
There's been a trend for big retailers to go into small retail units. Do you think that this is going to continue, Martin?
Well, I definitely think it's worthy of consideration because I really think that a large part of the future of the high street in the UK is going to be independent retail. And, you know, one of the restrictions that both smaller and larger businesses have obviously had, or one of the issues over recent years, has been the cost of rent and rates. So the rent side of things, to some extent, is being addressed by what we've been through with the pandemic. So these physical environments are going to become more cost-effective. Landlords are not going to be able to tie anybody into 10 or 25-year leases anymore. So you're going to see a lot more pop-ups. And these will be opportunities as well for bigger brands to take their proposition into, you know, smaller locales, but supported with, obviously, a very effective digital proposition.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky.
Please, people, do we honestly want to see every single high street with a Tesco's Express, a Marks and Spencer Express, a John Lewis Express? I mean, really?
On the subject of Debenhams, their relevance, shall we say, they lost it quite some time ago. And unfortunately, they got hijacked, in my opinion, by a private equity squeezing as much money as they could. That's my view. And some executive teams that I wasn't over impressed with. I'd also talk about a very interesting trend here. There's some really exciting stuff going on. A lot of the retailers that I think have been very smart, Nike being one of them, have jumped onto that trend. And I think the direct-to-consumer trend is one huge success story. Nike dropped into that trend in around about 2017, went from about 30,000 accounts to about 40. And decided, again, picking up on what Jonathan was saying on data, that they wanted their customers' data. And that kind of whole wholesale model where stores like Debenhams and Topshop and Arcadia are in charge of the customer data, these brands really need to get to know who their customers are and what they want.
Jonathan Sands, is it just Hollywood make-believe in terms of making the high street into a plastic place owned by these huge organizations?
The beauty of an independent trader is that they're able to obsess with the detail in their particular shops. With larger companies, and I certainly found this later, it becomes much more challenging in terms of the actual product that you are selling to that specific market and those customers in your shop, because there might be a generic model for the larger shops. With a smaller shop, you're a lot more nimble. You're able to change depending on your local market. To Martin's point, larger businesses are going to have to get a lot more creative to create those smaller independent look and feel stores than to just multiply a smaller version of themselves.
Susanna, it's another retail high street looking exactly the same as the other retail high street.
I don't actually think that that is what we're going to see, but I do think smaller shop fronts, as it were, a place where if you want to try on, you can, will be the way forward. And in the place of so many of the chains, you will get more independence springing up. I think that part of the issue was the very fact that if you went into a town centre, it's an identikit town centre to one 30 miles up the road. It isn't just happening as far as kind of fashion retail is concerned. All of the Jamie's restaurants, for example, people after a while, they want independence. They want family-run restaurants. They want more family-run businesses again. And you still will need to have, I truly believe, even it's interesting, for example, ASOS saying that they're hopefully going to still retain the Topshop store in Oxford Street. Because I think it's absolutely key that you are still able to go in and actually physically browse through the clothes, not just their landing in cellophane wrappers on your front doorstep and you turn your bedroom into a changing room. That's okay during the pandemic when you have no other option, but people do still actually want to go in and feel the clothes and see what they're buying. Not so many, but it would be good to have, you know, destination stores.
There's about £150 million, they're saying, in terms of people's savings. It's just waiting for the vaccine to finally work and everyone will start spending again. Do you agree with that, Martin?
I certainly do. I certainly do. I just want to make a quick point, though, just about what I was referring to, if you don't mind, in relation to the nationals coming into local high streets. I'm not suggesting that's going to happen in any significant way, but I think that if you reflect upon what one of the big behavioral changes that we're all going through in this whole work from home, that's going to continue. We will not go back to the office in the way that we used to do. We'll probably end up spending half the week at home, half the week going into town. So if you work back from that and you say all of a sudden, only half of the number of consumers that are normally in the West End on any given day in terms of domestic consumers, then as a big national business, you've got to do something about that. And either you try and capture that demand online, or you maybe look to tap into it locally. So I've been predicting for a while what I'm calling revenge consumption. So I think we've all got pent-up demand. To your point, we've all been saving money. If you look at the Office of National Statistics stats around household savings, they're at a higher rate than they even were when we had the global financial crash in 2007, 2008. So there's a lot of pent-up demand, and I've no doubt whatsoever retailers, hospitality, travel, and other sectors will be the beneficiaries of that when things open up.
Because we are living in a material world, and I'm a material girl. You know that we are living in a material world, and I'm a material girl.
On the shop floor, a retail panel discussion from Thought and Leaders.
Wasn't all this going to happen anyway? And all COVID has done is just made it go fast forward a little bit.
Well, I think that there's still a bit of a gap or a lag between the world that we live in today and the world that we used to live in prior to 1994. 1994 began the democratization of retail when the first transaction was conducted online. It took a while, obviously, for the web to get real penetration. That didn't start to happen until towards the end of the first decade in this millennium, sort of 2008, 2009, 2010. Fundamentally, what it all began is a shift in the balance of power from retailers to brands. I think Jonathan may have mentioned this earlier. And that's changed everything, because ultimately the customer decides where and when they go. They've got, you know, all this plethora of choice, literally a click away. And I think that understanding or lack of understanding is what differentiates the businesses that are successful today and the ones who won't have a sustainable business in the future. Because if you understand what that means, then you need to be where your customers are, and you need to be doing so many things well over and above just convenience and having the right product at the right price point.
Yeah.
You've got to have a focus on social responsibility.
Yes, Paul.
We're talking about stores and retailers that have been literally dragged, kicking and screaming into the digital age. Yes, it's sped things up, but these businesses that are unfortunately, sadly disappearing from our high streets that have been part of our generation's experience.
True.
To all of our Amazon retail heroes on the floor, in the air, and behind the wheel, we want to thank you. We'll continue to do everything we can to keep you healthy, safe, and protected. The work you are doing means everything right now. Thank you.
Trust Amazon.
Susanna, one retailer that definitely has all their ducks lined up in a row in terms of availability of product and at a good price, also it gets product to you very quickly, is Amazon. When people use their high street stores as showrooms, everyone's just going to be buying stuff on Amazon anyway because it's cheaper.
Amazon is trying to be a growing competitor in the world of fast fashion. It already dominates in basic apparel, but it is gaining ground in the high fashion stakes as well. Of course, it can gather data on popular styles of third-party sellers, and then it can create its own versions for its own labels, for example, like Goodthreads or Lark & Row, to try and win market share. And that trend really has been accelerating during the pandemic as people have spent more time at home looking for a fashion fix online.
Yeah.
Also, what it does do quite well is use its influencer program and partnered up with Vogue, for example, and is kind of directing followers of designers and stylists directly onto its site, trying to push up the luxury ladder in some way. I do actually think that, Boohoo really grasped that idea that brands had to be front and center of the proposition. And it's been scooping up brands left, right, and center. But Next as well has done very well in this sphere as well.
Jonathan Sands, there's been rumors that John Lewis, they're going to convert part of their buildings into accommodation and also into John Lewis flats. You can actually look around this flat, buy the stuff online. That's taking experiential into your line of work, isn't it?
Yeah.
Creating a set almost.
Yes. So in order to create sort of immersive environments, you have to have this really sort of clear vision about what your customer wants and how they want to live it, feel it, embrace it, buy it, whatever it is you want them to do. This is really about sort of singular visions. There's a lot of things going on here. John Lewis is kind of its own landlord, if you like.
Yeah.
So it can control the space from within. if we're looking at a high street, it's multiple landlords. And it's very hard for them to have a single vision as to what their high street, or in this case, John Lewis department store, should look like. One thing that we experienced in Covent Garden was that because it was one singular landlord, they had this incredible way of designing what they wanted and how they wanted the customers to feel. So they had their luxury street, they had their cosmetic street, fashion avenue, all these types of things. And in a way, when I was working at the airports, similar sort of vision. Unfortunately, the high street is made up of 20, 30 landlords and not necessarily all working together to have a collective kind of view as to what their high street should be.
Susanna, I mentioned this idea about turning part of the space into apartments or whatever it is that they're going to use. That gives a technical problem. If you start putting accommodation in these former department stores, which are in the middle of town, great from the point of view of location, 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 but it would kill the night economy, wouldn't it? And that's already suffering anyway. You can't have a thriving night economy when you've got people who are trying to get to sleep.
Well, actually, I don't think that necessarily the nighttime economy is in those really busy, or what have been up until now, busy retail thoroughfares. They're usually kind of carved out into other areas of the city. Sometimes there's a bit of a mix, but often I feel, say, for example, take Bristol City Centre. The nighttime economy is trend-led. Hmm. Sometimes it's one part of the city. You find a couple of years later, it's another part of the city.
So right.
I don't necessarily think that will have too much of an effect. I do think, though, that it will help with footfall, because over the pandemic, we have seen, particularly in high streets and shopping centres, footfall really struggle, even when shops are open once again, still languishing around 60%. And of course, with lockdowns way further down. In comparison, the out-of-town retail parks have seen footfall above 80% once those lockdown restrictions have eased. So the out-of-town shopping centres and retail parks are doing much better than the high street. So you really need to bring that footfall back in. Office workers aren't going to be coming back in the numbers, which was hoped because of the new working from home revolution. So I think really accommodation could be key to drawing back more people to those shops and city centres.
A lot of people have been talking about the ideas of turning these buildings into things like food halls, art galleries. Martin?
The concept of having more galleries, the concept of having other entertainment venues alongside hospitality, and having a good mix of that, then I can imagine that being an environment that people want to go to and want to spend time in. So I think it's got to be more than just retail. The environment itself needs to have a decent investment and needs to feel like a place that consumers want to go. And I think if we do that right, and then we get the mix of retail proposition right, where we have a good, strong, independent retail presence, along with those remaining national retail brands that are good at what they do, then I think you'll have a proposition that consumers will want to go back to.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan Sands, you are Mr. Hollywood here. Are you going to Hollywoodize our high streets then? Are we going to have waterfalls and light shows and things like that, are we?
I was brought up in Borehamwood in Elstree, and that was a film town. That has its strength. Every year in Barnet, we have a Barnet Fair in the high street, turns into like this amazing mix of sort of local talent, local artists, and all sorts. And why could there be more of that kind of encouragement? And I think everybody has a part to play in that, whether it's sort of government, local councils, landlords, local businesses. Mm-hmm. Every town centre has its strengths, depending on its geography. And once you create those points of difference, mm-hmm. people will go out of their way to go to other people's towns.
Mm. The likes of Mike Ashley have been going on and on and on, and Susanna, you'll know this, in the press for years about landlords. Do you think there's going to be a change in terms of the landlord's attitude towards retailers post-COVID?
Yeah, it's interesting about the rents, because of course that was the real problem for Debenhams. Debenhams has a hugely successful website, but it really was the rents that weighed it down and meant that it was unable to be nimble. It just had too big a footprint. What would be interesting to see is what happens with those huge Debenhams stores now brands have been taken over by Boohoo. How will town centres cope? Because it is going to be some time before pop-ups are able to pop up in those stores. The retailers and the landlords really have to work together.
Yeah.
And it's going to be really now on the landlords, I think, being more creative because the cash cow has gone.
Can I just say something on that?
Sure.
I just think that the brands that Boohoo have scooped up are interesting. But I think that if you look at where all of those brands have built their loyalty and their customers, it's all in the physical environment. And I do think that to create pull that emotional top shop in the 60s, 70s, 80s had, in the short term, it will work. You will see Boohoo and a lot of these digital businesses having to create a hybrid where they go onto physical stores.
Susanna, with the cash cow gone for landlords, will this provide an opportunity for independents and pop-ups to step in?
There is real appetite for many more independents to come in. I think the whole pop-up trend is one to be embraced. People love to go to a farmer's market, but they also love the kind of pop-up independents that have been able to thrive in some of the disused stores that we've seen in towns and cities across the country. So trying to involve them in the mix would be great. And I see the kind of store of the future as a much smaller footprint where people can dry out the styles, the fashions that they like, and then order them there and then in store, go out and have lunch and go to one of the independent cafes or restaurants or one of the chains which are still thriving, and then a bit later go and pick up what they've bought later on in the day, which by then would have arrived from one of the huge distribution warehouses on the outside of the cities and town centres.
Jonathan, a brave new web distributed world?
As much as we've kind of leapt forward insofar as, you know, more people are buying online, I think we've also gone back to traditional routes, to the independent trader, where that has suddenly had a kind of renaissance, if you like.
Susanna, prior to COVID, rents were all over the place. Landlords were being accused of overcharging. Post-COVID, is it time for the government to finally step in?
With so many of these retail spaces now empty, there is going to have to be some kind of realization that the rents are going to become actually a lot more competitive to try and lure people back in. There will be a dawning realization that this can't continue. You see, the problem, though, is that there are other retailers who are still tied into these high rents. And so some may actually want to keep these stores empty to make sure that they maintain the high level rents.
So are you saying that there's going to be just empty stores, not just because of economic reasons in terms of people are not buying it, but basically they're just going to keep them empty in terms of manipulating the rates?
There is a risk.
Good grief.
There is a risk that that could happen, because otherwise it's kind of almost going to be a free-for-all going right down to the rock bottom. They might rather keep a store empty to try and get a high-level retailer who is willing to pay a high level of rent,
yeah,
rather than opening up to a whole raft of independents. So I think that is going to be a bit of a struggle going forward. And it may be the local authority needs to come in and supplement in some way, provide some kind of financial incentive.
Really?
For independents to be able to move into that space.
So the government has to step in?
I think there will be various different grants given out, and there will be a demand for financial incentives from local authorities, which inevitably will come from the government or local taxation, to support the revitalization of town centres. And it could be that it's a financial incentive, agreements with landlords to offer a lower rate with some kind of incentive. Mm. It is very going to be very difficult to find out exactly how they do that. But I do think that there is going to be a demand for grants to ensure that there is a future for these empty spaces.
Jonathan Sands, last word on that?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. there's all sorts of sort of schemes with sort of rate relief and all that sort of stuff that, that could potentially be looked at. But I think you're right. Landlords as a whole have, you know, necessarily pushed up some of the issue and pushed out some of the independents, and they need to reverse that and get some of the independent and encourage the independents to come back. They're all there. It's just about affordability.
On the Shop Floor, a retail panel discussion from Thought and Leaders.
So if someone was thinking about opening up a store post-COVID, what would be three pieces of advice that you would give them, bearing in mind what has happened in COVID? And I'm going to start that one off with Paul.
Well, no high street's the same. Susanna was talking about how not only every high street, every shopping mall in every country looks the same. And the consumer shopper today is so sophisticated, anything that's not authentic or anything that is, you know, not in line with what they need will just be shunned. So I think you have to look at each high street on the people who are in that area, which is going to be different. But I think, yeah, immersive and mixing food and drink, hospitality, it's just got to be a mix. It was okay the way it was before, but I think in the last sort of 20, 25 years, it kind of got hijacked by these big retailers who put their vision on our high streets. And I think, you know, that's the key.
Retail revolution, Jonathan Sands.
Yes, I would say my three points are product, service, and execution. So product, how different is my product to my next door neighbor? How original is it? How unique is it? What sets it apart? Service, you know, how do I elevate the service and the customer experience? And then ultimately execution, how am I going to sell it in the most original and effective way?
Fantastic. Susanna.
A lot of people, if they want to go into retail, they want to be a shopkeeper. They want to have a store and sell things to people coming into the store. The problem is now that store is online as well. So there has to be a seamless experience between the actual physical store and the digital store. And it's really important not to neglect the digital store. In fact, probably focus first on how you're going to sell your product online and then think about how you're going to showcase it to real people. That could be via a pop-up store, for example. It could be via a shop. But I think it's that seamless transition between the online and the physical store that is really crucial. And I've been struck by the very fact that I've wanted to support independents over the past 6 months desperately. And I walk past the shops and there is not, on many of them, there is no online store that you can go and click and collect or you can purchase something. And you're peering through the windows, you know, in frustration, thinking, come on, just get your online proposition right and I would be your customer.
Martin.
Well, the old retail mantra of location, location, location will always ring true. So I think making sure your store is in the right place where you've got the right adjacencies in terms of the businesses around you, as well as having good footfall that passes the shop for passing trade, I think is really key. So that's certainly still relevant. I think as COVID has proven, you need to have more than just a physical presence because God forbid this should happen again. If you just had a physical retail store and no online presence, you'd be in trouble. So you need a digital presence, which you can have through your own website. But then you can also get onto platforms like downyourhighstreet.com, which enable you to have that, to extend your reach beyond your local high street. And then apart from that, I think the third thing I would just say is retail is all about experience. So have a think about not only what you're going to sell, but how do you sell it and how can you provide services? And one of the things that local, smaller, independent retailers have done well with during this period is supporting their local community by delivering products to people's houses, particularly those of us that have had to self-isolate. So I think those are the three main pieces of advice that I would offer.
Well, everybody. Everyone would love to be your customers and clients. So how can listeners get hold of you? Let's start with Paul.
Paul at lily.blue. Come and see me on LinkedIn or hear me on LinkedIn as I'm there posting day and night.
We never close. We are the LinkedIn equivalent of Arkwright Stores. Okay. And Jonathan Sands.
Yes, you can get hold of me at jonathan@artisticlicense with the dot just before the S in license.
Martin, if people wanted to get hold of you, find out about your book, about your services, how do they do that?
Sure. Well, my book, The Power of Customer Experience, my second book comes out on the 3rd of May, published by Kogan Page. It will be available on Amazon. I think it can be pre-ordered through the Kogan Page website at the moment. And if you just want to get in touch with me, you can reach me, martin@martinnewman.co.uk. If you have a customer service issue that you would like us to help resolve, you can go on to www.customerserviceaction.com.
Ah, okay. And of course, Susanna.
Yes, well, I am also on LinkedIn and I'm on Twitter at Streeter News. And you can email me at susanna.streeter@hl.co.uk at Hargreaves Lansdown.
Brilliant. So to everyone, thank you very much to the distinguished panel. Whether it's going to be online, whether it's going to be offline, the main thing is that when the economy is feeling a bit more confident, we go out there and we buy. Until next time, take care.
Welcome to New London, the ultimate shopping experience. Here, your AI chip loves your consumer soul. We are your brand family.
Thought and Leaders is a Goodbye production. Subscribe today via your preferred podcasting app.